Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here, and we're trying something new, packaging three of our favorite segments from the week for you to listen to on the weekend in case you missed them. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Have a great weekend. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. James Baldwin would have turned 90 this year. You may have read The Fire Next Time or Go Tell It to the Mountain or Notes of a Native Son. He was an essayist, poet, novelist, and as you can hear, a social critic.
First of all, I'm speaking as an American citizen. I'm speaking as also as a grandson of a slave.
My mother was born in Maryland. My father was born in New Orleans. I was born in New York.
Someone who represents a very complex country which insists on being simple-minded.
As a black and gay writer who was prolific in the mid-20th century, Baldwin's work persists, and a year-long celebration launches next week to recognize his contributions and his activism. This year's festival from New York Live Arts is called James Baldwin This Time. Joining us now is the festival's curator, Lawrence Weschler, who wears many hats, among them nonfiction writer. Hello, Ren.
Hi, great to be here again.
The writer Jamaica Kincaid, who is participating in the opening keynote conversation, also joins us. Her most recent work is See Now Then. Jamaica Kincaid, thank you very much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
And with us is Rich Blint, who is a Baldwin scholar and associate director of the Office of Community Outreach and Education for the School of Arts at Columbia University. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
Professor Blint. Ren Weschler, there have been many conferences and celebrations and remembrances of James Baldwin, and I think you have a nod to that in the title of this particular year-long series. You call it James Baldwin This Time. Mm-hmm. So we'll bite. Why James Baldwin at this time?
I really do feel, and several of us who got this going were having a conversation about this, that Baldwin is arguably, of that generation of writers, the most salient, the most pertinent, notwithstanding one of the most gorgeous writers, but mm-hmm. also the things he was writing about are so pertinent to the situation right now of all times when we are supposedly at a post-racial moment. We have a president who's black, so we don't need to think about this anymore. But whereas on the contrary, at a time when voter registration is under attack, when we have 10 times more prisoners in prison today than when Baldwin was writing about this problem. I mean, the things that Baldwin was getting at are so important. And so there's a whole group of us, and it began with Harlem Stage up in Harlem. That's going to be part of this in Columbia and us. And we got together and we just said we should have a whole year devoted. It strikes me that Baldwin is, if anything, a little bit occluded in the conversation. He should be absolutely one of the first people talk about.
So, Jamaica Kincaid, you're participating in the opening keynote conversation on April 23rd, I see, along with the choreographer Bill T. Jones and the artist Carrie Mae Weems. How do you see your connection as a writer or as an American to James Baldwin?
Oh, my goodness. I was just reading an essay of his about being an artist. It's called The Artist's Struggle for Integrity. And I kept, as I read it, I kept thinking, when was this written? It's there's something so eternal about it, so fresh, so extraordinary, pertinent and personal, as if it was written only for me, or, well, not only for me, but I think everyone who does something called art will read it and think, oh, this is just this conversation that this writer directed solely for me. He's so, as Ren said, so salient. It's impossible to not think of him every day. At some point earlier, I was talking to Hilton Owls, and I said to him, I thought that every African-American household ought to just have a complete collection of James Baldwin's work just as a kind of penance, because there was something that he did that was extraordinary for an artist. He gave so much to this his tribe, as he called it, and he was always seems to be shifting tribes. Sometimes the tribe was us African Americans. Sometimes it was other artists, you know. But he just was so full of this extraordinary thing. I've never heard a writer use the word love in this way so often.
In what way?
Love for community, love for people. He even thought, he actually seemed to think that the problem with white Americans was that they didn't love themselves, that the problem with racism wasn't really hatred of us, but it was hatred of themselves, that love of themselves would prevent them from participating in the horrible things they participated in and perpetrated in our society.
Professor Blent, you're nodding.
I'm nodding because Baldwin says love is a growing up. And he also said, I don't want to be white, I want to grow up. He also said love has never been a popular movement and no one's ever really wanted to be free. And so for him, it has always been the quality, the quantity of love that will overhaul, as I've been saying for some time now, our current crisis, you know, a kind of protracted crisis.
Yeah.
That word has fallen out of our public discourse. It's funny. I notice when I prepare this Martin Luther King celebration that we do every year, how much the word love shows up in his speeches in a political context.
Exactly.
And then recently I realized LBJ too, in the context of the Civil Rights Act.
Yes.
He talked about, can you imagine even President Obama standing up there and speaking in terms of love? I think he'd get laughed off the podium.
But this is not touchy-feely Haight-Ashbury love. This is a very complicated thing. And just as one of the things that's fascinating about him that for me is so exciting is he uses this we, and it is we Americans he's talking about, and we Americans have a problem with love. And America is a huge problem, and it's a very, very complicated thing he's talking about, and love. And it has to do with authenticity and the flight from love, which is a huge thing he talks about, is really important. And I look at the House of Representatives, for example, and I think that all the time.
Flight from love.
Yeah.
Jamaica Kincaid, did you want to keep going on that?
Oh.
Sounded like you were trying to get in.
I was agreeing. No, I'm struck by that, and Ren is right. It's not just feely love. Love turns out, to be this very difficult thing. Love turns out to be hard work, and love turns out to be, and by the hard work, I mean love is action. You know, and if you love someone and you see them drowning, you try your the act of love is to save them, is to maybe even risk your own life. It's not just sort of to wave and send a card. That love was really something that you do, that you practice. It had a muscle tone to it. It had a real activity to it. And but I was constantly overwhelmed by that feeling, and especially in the essays. And it's in the essays for me, you know, that his artistry just comes alive, just and the freshness of it, the devotion. As I say, just sort of every household, certainly in the African community, because I sometimes feel that among the things that happened to him, one central thing is that he sacrificed the artist got somehow a lot less. The artist got less than the person writing the essays. But the essays themselves become superior art. They are just of an extraordinary level of thinking and of shape, of form, that is humbling to read.
Just to follow up on that and about the injunction to have every African American, I would say every American household should have Baldwin's tenets. But for me, we have to understand love as a kind of moral proposition, right? And so the flight that Ren just spoke about is the flight from our kind of common disaster, our shared, really complex, contradictory history. And so when Baldwin evokes love, it's not romantic love or things like that, although he talks about that as well. It's much more about a kind of historical confrontation, historical encounter.
And so here's another clip of Baldwin, and this was just after a famous meeting that he had with then U.S. Attorney General Robert Kennedy.
I think that one has got to find some way of putting the present administration of this country on the spot. One has got to force somehow from Washington a moral commitment, not to the Negro people, but to the life of this country. It doesn't matter any longer, and I'm speaking for myself, for Jimmy Baldwin, and I think I'm speaking for a great many other Negroes too. It doesn't matter any longer what you do to me. You can put me in jail, you can kill me, but by the time I was 17, you'd done everything that you could do to me. The problem now is, how are you going to save yourselves?
James Baldwin, 1963. And Professor Blant, you smiled, you put your hand to your heart when you realized what clip that was going to be. Why?
That conversation I explored for some time, and he was so candid there. He was very disappointed after that meeting with Bobby Kennedy. He was with Lorraine Hansberry and some others. And in that interview with Kenneth Clark, he is, like he says, you can't do anything else to me, you know? And he's asking for a certain moral commitment in 1963 at a time when our country was in crisis and in some ways still remains in crisis. So that clip always does it for me, Brian. It's just really pointed and direct. And again, his moral imagination is so clear.
Was that the conversation, by the way, where Bobby Kennedy said that you might be able to be president in 40 years?
Absolutely.
Tell that story. That's amazing.
I mean, he said, Bobby Kennedy recently made me the soul-stirring promise that 30 years, if I'm lucky, I can be president too. And he goes on to say, never entered this boy's mind, never entered this country's mind, but that perhaps I wouldn't want to be. And what he says is he's not concerned with any Negro first. That would really exercise his mind what kind of country that president would be president of. And I think that's a question, right? Baldwin's always concerned with content, not symbolism. Like, again, real transformation, you know?
Hence James Baldwin this time.
And so there's a Baldwin quote that you were just referring to about a hypothetical, quote, first Negro president. And I know that you both know this quote. So Baldwin wrote, quote, and in any case, what really exercises my mind is not this hypothetical day on which some other Negro first will become the first Negro president. What I am really curious about is just what kind of country he will be president of.
Exactly.
That seems prophetic.
Right?
Yeah.
So what do you think he'd be looking at today with President Obama? Do you ask yourself that question?
Well, one of the things we're going to be—I mean, we're going to have a whole session at the initial festival, and I again to reiterate, the festival that's April 23rd to April 27th at New York Live Arts is just the launch of a whole year of events that'll take place at Columbia and at the Harlem Stage and so forth. But one of our events is going to be precisely what would he think of what's going on with voter registrations? What would he make of the Tea Party? We're asking all those questions, but actually you—
Yeah, the answer is obvious to those questions.
Well, no. It is obvious, and yet it is deep. And when I say it's salient, what he would precisely make of it is actually, he wouldn't just condemn it or something. He would talk about America and about a deep, deep, soulful, deep problem in America that is something that people should be talking about. And I think, frankly, that's one of the paucity, the thinness of political discourse in this country is part of why you need Baldwin right now.
Absolutely. Jamaica.
Oh, I was going to say the political discourse or the artistic discourse. I mean, it's still sort of astonishing, and I hope this doesn't sound too self-serving, but it's just I think that there were perhaps more people of color prominently publishing, for instance, or artists than there are now. I mean, one of the astonishing things, you look at any of the publications that deal with the arts, and it's just sort of strangely peach-colored or doesn't look an awful lot like him there, or that kind of artistic voice, that kind of energy seems not to be encouraged. You know, you have people having a lot, so much of what a writer's life is living in, you know, Brooklyn or some stupid place like that. Or, but there doesn't seem to be that sort of vitality, but maybe it's true in all the arts, but I can't find a voice like that. Mm. I can't find an engagement like that with society. I can't find it in you know, the world, I don't know what to call it, the white world. But the thing that you see in his work, in his novels, and in the essays, but in the art, I'm sorry.
That's okay. And as we talk about James Baldwin in what would have been his 90th birthday year, Jamaica, if you want to finish that thought, or we'll go to a caller.
Oh, I just was going to say, you know, taking on that with risk, that vitality, risking your reputation, risking your place in the social order. Just saying something that upsets things, that speaks to something true. I think an amazing aspect of him was this compulsion almost, and this devotion to something he called the truth. Not that he knew what the truth was, but he was going to pursue it. And I'm so inspired and amazed at that miss so much that kind of passion and that kind of devotion to the truth.
Let's take a caller. Kyla in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Kyla.
Good morning, Brian. I'm so happy. It's been a number of years since I've called in, and this is my favorite topic. I went to Vassar, and I was an American culture major, whatever that means, and my education was centered around the work of James Baldwin. I studied under the late scholar Stephen Moore, who was really a master of his work. And, you know, I'm mixed race. My family is Jamaican and Jews, Holocaust survivors. And I grew up in New York City, and so I was always sort of looking around at racism and trying to understand this American experience. And when I opened The Fire Next Time, and the copy I had was my dad's from when he went to City College as a recent immigrant, and it suddenly opened the door to understand what the experience of being American meant and what it was. And through his work, through his fiction, and through mostly his nonfiction, I could really step across that boundary and claim my own Americanness. It was very healing for me to understand that America wasn't this thing I'd learned about in history books with white people over here and black people over here, but rather there was this common soul and this common experience of trauma and pain and liberation and resistance, and that had to come together in each one of us, as well as in the society at large. And so it's beautiful to listen to Ms. Kincaid and others talk about his legacy today, because it really is that complex, that devotion of self, the understanding who you are, that might save our nation. And I think that's what Baldwin was really speaking to, and it helped me as a young woman immeasurably.
Lawrence Beschler?
Yeah, I just want to say two quick points. One of them that's fascinating about Baldwin is he has to leave America. He has to save his own life. In 1948, he flees America. He's convinced if he didn't, he would either be a drug addict or a prisoner or dead. And he goes to Paris. And
this is the late 1940s.
Late 1940s. And it's actually in Paris, and partly under the thrall of Henry James, actually, in Paris, that he discovers that what he is isn't a black person or a gay person, but an American. And from that point forward, all of his writing is about that. One of the things that's fascinating there, by the way, is that his writing about, for example, in Giovanni's Room, where he writes all the characters are white, by the way, but he writes about a deeply closeted, dishonest man who can't come to terms with his own sexuality, that he actually is gay and is living this totally false life. And that's interesting in itself. But what's really interesting is that becomes a figure for what America is doing all the way through. One other thing, just very quickly, by the way, she mentioned Fire Next Time. One of the things I urge people to come by, even if you're not going to attend any of the events at New York Live Arts on 19th Street, come by, because we have this Hank Willis Thomas 5-screen thing that you've been playing pieces of. But also upstairs, we have taken the Fire Next Time, how it first appeared in The New Yorker in November 1962, and we've made a mural out of its appearance. And to see it running one column of text with 5 columns of advertising, all of it luxury ads, all of it madman. Huh. It's just so strange. There's not a single black face in any of the ads. On the very last page, where he rises to that crescendo about if we don't deal with this, it's going to be no more water the fire next time. On one of that, it's an ad for jewelry, and the text is "Chains abound."
Wow.
It's an amazing thing to look at.
Where can people see that again?
That'll be on 19th Street at 219 West 19th, which is the New York Live Arts, which is where the whole festival will be taking place between April 23rd and April 27th. But if you just go by, you can just go take a look at it. And it's really something to look at. A wall of the New Yorker and it's basically Don Draper's wet dream. Yeah.
And inadvertent contrast.
Right. It's amazing.
Let's play one more audio clip of James Baldwin, who was a great public speaker, and he debated William F. Buckley in 1965. The premise was the American dream is at the expense of the American Negro, quote. And we have a video of the whole debate up on our site at WNYC.org. It's long, nearly an hour, but worth watching for many of you, and it's certainly worth playing a clip right now. So the audience at the Cambridge Union Society was pretty much entirely white. And as you can see in the video, they are totally captivated by Baldwin's remarks, 33 seconds of which we hear now.
And in the moment you are born, since you don't know any better, every stick and stone and every face is white. And since you have not yet seen a mirror, you suppose that you are too. It comes as a great shock around the age of 5 or 6 or 7 to discover the flag to which you have pledged allegiance along with everybody else, has not pledged allegiance to you. It comes as a great shock to discover that Gary Cooper killing off the Indians when you were rooting for Gary Cooper, that the Indians were you.
The Indians were you. Mm-hmm. And I guess the punchline is that in that debate before a white audience, on the premise the American dream is at the expense of the American Negro, true or false, Baldwin won that debate 540 to 160 in a vote of the audience.
Yes, he did. I mean, that's really incredible. I've listened to that and watched that so many times. But it's a profound indictment of American society. And when he says that the American dream is at the expense of the American Negro, he also says in the beginning of Notes of a Native Son, published in 1955, that the history of America is the history of the Negro in America, right? So that inextricable kind of bounding up is what he was always concerned with. To go back to the caller before, who came to terms with what it means to be on this soil through Baldwin, right? This kind of code citizen, this common disaster ethos. That was I guess that was his gospel. He said he left the church to preach the gospel, and that was the moral terrain on which he operated.
But it wasn't a black problem. It was a white problem. Or it was an American problem. In other words, he doesn't even believe that there are blacks as such. I mean,
right? He doesn't. I mean, he says, as long as you think you're white, there's no hope for you. So what he's getting at there is not just the invention of race in America as a modern advent, but just the mythology around it, the associations that set him and a crew around this thing that's only, at that time, 100 and a half years old or 200 years old.
We're over time, but let me take one more caller, because Murphy in Manhattan says he teaches Baldwin in a lit class. Murphy, just give us the context. Who do you teach? How do you use Baldwin?
It's in Bed-Stuy.
Uh-huh. What grade?
It's the old boys' high. I shouldn't say anymore. I might get in trouble. But it's a beautiful old building. No prison.
Walls. School's off today. You're allowed to be calling in.
Say it again?
School's out today for break. You're allowed to be calling in.
Yes, that's why I'm listening. I can't listen. I would be teaching right now. I would be teaching some boring Regents class.
And you teach James Baldwin and Jamaica Kincaid?
Yes, both. If Beale Street Could Talk, mm-hmm, and Annie John are central texts for my class.
And how? Give me a flavor. Give me something.
Well, you know what's really sad? They don't want to read. They have to, like, force feed the reading. It's very sad.
Welcome to high school.
But once they get into it. Beale Street is more, you know, when you say it's a girl who's pregnant and the guy's in jail with a racist cop, they kind of get into it. Annie John's a tougher sell, but once they start reading it, they love it.
By the way, one of the things that's going to happen, all 5 days of the festival, April 23rd through 27th at New York Live Arts, at noon, we're going to have all kinds of amazing people reading for free the works of James Baldwin.
Like who?
Oh, God, we're going to have V.J. Iyer, the musician, Robert Krolwich, of all people, is going to be Kathleen Chalfant.
Our own from Radio Live.
Right. Kathleen Chalfant.
Issa Davis, Toshi Regan, Che Gossett, incredible people. We're reading from noon to 1:30 every day at New York Live Arts.
Let's wrap it up this way. You have each said that Americans, I think somebody said Black Americans and somebody else said Americans, should have the collected work of James Baldwin in their home. Assuming that that's a high bar, what's the first thing that people who never read Baldwin should read? You want to leave us with that, each of you, on your way out the door, Professor Rich Blent from Columbia University?
I would go with the collection Notes of a Native Son.
I think I would go with that too. But in particular, I think I would read the Notes of a Native Son.
Yeah. I would go with Fire Next Time, for example, would be a very good place to start. But also in this in the short story collection, Going to Meet the Man. That story and Sonny's Blues, I mean, those are both relatively short stories. And if that doesn't get you, nothing will.
Jamaica what?
East Beals, yes. I mean, I wouldn't know where to begin. Every time I think, oh, this is it, I read something else. And, I mean, what's amazing is the extraordinary capacity for saying something new about this seemingly intractable, this intractable heart of the white person, whatever that is, the white person. Why would anyone want to be a white person?
Well, maybe there are white people who are like, okay, I'm me, that's it, it's okay. I just have to, you know, understand what it actually means in historical and present context.
Well, that's the price of the ticket, isn't it, right? What it actually
that
means.
That is the price of the ticket. Which is another, yes, that's the final.
Hopefully it's the price of the ticket of any privilege, if that's what we're really talking about, to
the
look at your privilege.
The ticket is freedom.
That's it right there, Jamaica.
And so we leave it there with Jamaica Kincaid, Rich Blent, Lawrence Wechsler, and you can find the links on our site to this whole shebang of James Baldwin events at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, also some of the videos and other things that we've been talking about and excerpting from. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
I'm Manoush Zomorodi, the host of WNYC's New Tech City, and I am thrilled to be sitting in for Brian Lehrer. On today's show, we'll be talking to Ralph Nader. We'll talk about why fussy babies get more screen time and how to catch a feral cat. But to kick things off, this is sort of awkward yet comforting. My first guest ever on the Brian Lehrer Show is New York One politics reporter Josh Robin. He's been following the controversy over horse-drawn carriages and whether or not they should be banned. And it should be noted that Josh also happens to be my husband. Please don't hold it against him. Josh, hello.
Oh, that's funny. Good morning.
Okay, so Josh, carriage horses are back on the op-ed pages, the tabloid front pages. The Daily News is launching a campaign to save them. Liam Neeson is leading the charge, the movie star. Just remind us, how big of a business is this actually?
Well, there are about a little less than 200 horses and a number of carriage drivers as well. And they're allowed to go, as many New Yorkers know and people from outside of New York, they're allowed to go basically around Central Park and also, you know, areas near there. They're generally housed on the far west side in stables. And as horse carriage advocates and drivers will tell you, they've been doing this for many, many years. In fact, they'll say that Central Park was designed by Frederick Law Olmsted in order to provide the best possible views from the back of a horse-drawn carriage. And more than a century later, the views are still gorgeous, they'll say, from the back of a horse-drawn carriage.
Okay, so listeners, we can take a couple calls on this. There are a lot of ideas for ways to better protect the horses instead of an outright ban. Do you want to offer your own? Call us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or post your comment to our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. So, Josh, the animal protection group calling for the ban on carriage horses, they played a big part in the Democratic mayoral primary, right?
They did. It's a really interesting story. It involves, you know, old New York and new money and Citizens United and the mayor's race. So, you know, it has a little bit for everyone. NYCLAS is the big group that is looking to ban horse-drawn carriages and instead replace them with antique replica environmentally friendly cars. And they pumped a lot of money.
Wait. Antique replica environmentally friendly cars.
Yeah, so a little
what
bit
of. What do you know about that?
All right. So these cars are being built down or designed down in Florida. Actually, later on today, they're going to be on display for the first time at the auto show where I'm going to be headed later this afternoon. And they look like, you know, a turn of the 20th century car, except they're powered by batteries and they chug around Central Park, and that's supposed to be the replacement for the horse-drawn carriages. So in other words, the drivers would no longer be pulling the reins but rather steering the steering wheel. The NYCLAS group feels like this is a perfectly reasonable solution. You know, the folks who were employed driving horses would instead be ferrying around tourists and New Yorkers.
So no one loses their jobs in this case.
That's right, except that, you know, there's a lot of questions about that, and I'm sure that callers are going to opine on it. Certainly the Daily News and the Post and the Times are on their editorial page. The cars themselves, some people feel that, you know, Central Park should have fewer cars, not more cars. Also, you know, to be frank about it, the drivers don't want to drive cars. They want to drive horses, and a lot of people still want horses within the city. You know, they feel it's a tradition and they feel like the horses aren't being treated poorly, that this is some sort of fabrication on the part of the other side. The other side, equally heated, will say that these horses are being abused.
Now, let's talk about the mayor and where he stands on this. He came out calling it, quoting from his website, the inhumane treatment of carriage horses, unquote. And he supported an immediate ban on the business, right?
Right. During the campaign, he said he was going to do it immediately. First, he said on the first day, then it became the first week. Now, if you ask him, it's more the first year. You know, look, whether this is politics or whether this is exactly what he believes, only he can say. But what I can say is that this group, NYCLAS, was extremely effective in getting him in turning him from and also ran in the Democratic primary to the ultimate winner. They provided, in the words of their director, a platform for people who were incredibly unhappy with what was going on in the city. And that's not just the fact that horses were circling Central Park, but also the fact that many people saw Christine Quinn as too closely aligned to Mayor Bloomberg. So NYCLAS raised a lot of money, $1.7 million. It was a separate private group. So this is kind of taking advantage of an environment that was loosened under Citizens United, arguably. And they allowed people to really target Quinn. Probably the second most effective campaign ad. That probably seems a long time ago for people.
Yeah.
But people remember the Dante ad for de Blasio with his son. Probably the second most effective campaign ad was an attack ad that a group affiliated with NYCLAS ran that painted Christine Quinn as sort of a creature of old smoky backrooms.
So let's bring it back to recent politics now. And just last week, the mayor had a Google Hangout to talk about his first 100 days in office. And here's a clip from him describing how he feels about the horses.
It's just about as common sense as you could possibly think that a horse in the middle of the streets of Midtown, it doesn't belong, isn't going to be able to live the kind of life that it should and is going to create a dynamic for everyone that creates problems. And I think a humane society doesn't do that.
So, Josh, what do we know about the health and well-being of horses?
Well, you know, it's mixed. I mean, first of all, the veterinarians on both sides will argue that either the horses are fine or the horses are doing horribly. So ultimately, no one and everyone should recognize that no one but the horses themselves can tell us exactly how they're doing. But these horses are routinely checked. They're given exams. There have been some fatalities over the years that the opponents will point to. The other side will say, you know, these are few and far between. You know, the horses themselves are kept in stalls that are at least 60 square feet, and they have to have 5 weeks of vacation out in the country each year.
That sounds pretty good.
Well, you know, I've talked to so many experts on this, and you know, probably the most important thing for horses is that they're allowed to obviously, apart from their eating and their recreation and so forth, it's for them to socialize with other horses.
Really?
Yeah, they're very social beings. So horses, there might be a better situation where the horses are allowed to interact a little bit more than between just the bars of their stalls. The problem is that this is New York, and you know, you can't just exactly build like a 5-acre paddock in the middle of Central Park. My sense is that there'll be at least floated compromises where stables are built that are closer to where the horses actually trot around Central Park, so the horses don't have to go through the streets. But that's a while off.
Okay, so let's go to a call. We've got John in Paramus, New Jersey. Hi, John.
Hi. Quickly, I think the horses should be allowed to be in Central Park only, not in Times Square or the theater. And I think they should have a dedicated time to leave the stables on the west side, close the lane off on the street, and a dedicated time to come back, you know, at 8 o'clock at night or something like that, and close the traffic. I don't disagree they should be banned, but they should not be in around the theater district and Times Square at night, because I drive for a living, and it's really a hassle. They shouldn't do that. And one other thing, you know, they want to get rid of the horses. What makes you think the horses are going to go to a better life? They could go to some farm and be just as badly treated anyway, or mistreated or whatever. So I think they live a pretty good life, but I do think they should be out of Times Square. They should be limited only to Central Park.
Thank you so much, John. Josh, that point that he makes, John and Paramus makes, is that how do we know that life is going to be any better for these horses in these sanctuaries?
Well, the legislation would say that they have to be provided for in an area where, you know, they're not, let's say, being turned into Jello or something like that. I mean, they're doing something. That's part of the legislation, and I'm sure that idea that John is floating is going to be part of these discussions within the city council. You know, by the way, this was supposed to happen again a few months ago. The mayor instead concentrated on people and other issues on pre-K. His political clout is diminished right now. And at the same time, and this is a story that we're running now on New York One, one wonders whether the opponents of the ban, that is the industry themselves, have really gotten some momentum behind them. I'm looking at the front page of the Daily News today. They have this campaign to save horses. It's not often that the New York Post and the New York Times editorial board agree. They're on the same page with this. You have unions who are backing the drivers. And also, I imagine that you're going to start to see transit advocates say these cars are not a good idea. Again, we should have fewer cars in parks rather than more of them.
So, Josh, we've actually got a carriage driver on the line, Steve Malone, based here in New York City. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for calling in. What do you think about that listener's idea in Paramus that they should only be restricted to the park, that these horse-drawn carriages should not be anywhere else?
We are restricted to the park 95% of the day, as it is right now. We are only allowed in Times Square after 11:30 at night when the traffic has subsided. So, you know, that doesn't really hold too much water with me, because we are restricted to the park. The idea that we're driving these horses through Times Square in the middle of the afternoon and those the tailpipe existence doesn't exist. You know, we're in the park 95% of the time.
See,
and as far as this closing down lanes, you know, you have to have some sort of cause and effect. We don't have accidents going back and forth to the stables. They're very, very rare. So I know, as John says, he drives for a living, and I'm sure he does a very good job at what he does. I would hate to think that I would be causing an effect on his job by closing down streets and not allowing him to do his job properly just because people want to see the horses walk up and down free of cars.
So, Steve, the mayor's idea to preserve your job, instead of horses, you would potentially drive an antique car. How do you feel about that?
He's not preserving my job. I'm a businessman. I own a business. We have 72 small businesses. Part of this plan also, which hasn't been touched on, is let's talk about the fact that they're going to seize my personal property from me, my personal horse. I've done nothing wrong, okay? I have done nothing wrong. My horses are as healthy as any horse in this country, and I'll put our horses up against any horses in this country. Horses need regulation. There's 144 pages of regulations to protect the horse in all kinds of conditions that was passed in the city hall in 2010. So his business plan steals my horse, or New York Class's business plan, I should say, steals my horse, and then gives me $150,000 worth of debt to buy this antique car that doesn't have any market. It's preposterous.
Steve, it's Josh here. What are your thoughts about, considering the fact that the mayor is so much on record opposing your industry, and same with the city council speaker, doesn't it seem to be that there has to be some sort of face-saving compromise reached, perhaps where lanes are blocked off, or perhaps where the horses are moved closer to where 95% of your runs are?
Well, listen, if you're proposing putting stables in the park, nobody here in the industry would be against it. You know, we have bicycle lanes all over the city. We can definitely do that. Closing streets down, I don't think, is the proper solution. I mean, the last thing that the carriage industry wants to do is to upset other New Yorkers trying to earn a living. So, you know, I don't think that's an alternative solution. As far as the mayor's, you know, plan, I've met with many city council people that have been against us, many that have come to us, have seen the stables, seen the care, and then have changed their mind. And that's what we hope to do with the mayor. We just would like to get him to come to meet us. As far as him calling it inhumane society, I look at it the other way. We have 144 pages of regulation. That's what a humane society does. The humane society puts its animals and cares for them in the proper way with five different agencies overseeing them. You know, we're not running back alley business here. We're out in the public. We're out front. Josh, you know yourself. You called me within an hour. We had you in the stable. We're an open book.
Yeah, well, I would imagine. I mean, he says that he is going to be meeting with you, so I imagine that's going to be happening.
We absolutely look forward to it.
Okay, Steve, thank you so much for calling in. We really appreciate it. And we're going to go now to Paula in Manhattan. Paula, are you there?
Yes, I'm there. Hi.
Tell us what you think about this.
I have one thing that I read or heard a couple of weeks ago, which really prickled me because I am a pro horse and carriage person. I think that they are so regulated and, you know, so integral to the city. They're like the gondolas in Venice. You can't have New York without them. But with the real estate angle, and hearing your speaker talk more about moving the stables to the park, which is a great idea, once again points to that so there's a real estate interest in the stable property. And I'd like to know more about the legitimacy of that claim.
Thank you so much, Paula. Josh, that's sort of what Liam Neeson has been writing about, right? He's suggested that the ban was funded by real estate interests who want to develop the land on the far west side that now house the stables. Is there anything to that?
Well, here's what I can say. That land is extremely valuable. It's been recently rezoned. The subway, the 7, is going out there, so it's no longer, you know, sort of this no man's land. At the same time, I can say that that NYCLASS is bankrolled generally by someone who made a lot of money in real estate, but they are vehemently dismissive of any suggestion that he's after anything other than the welfare of the horses. He's a horse lover, they say. The actual – you know, that's the best I can do as far as reporting both sides. But I will say that real estate line is something that has a tremendous amount of traction among those who want to keep the horses as is.
Now, listeners, we have a full board of people calling in, but no one who actually supports the ban. So we're going to try to save a line for you. Call us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. If you do support the ban of horse-drawn carriages. Josh, Liam Neeson also mentioned an idea of moving those stables to the park, and the Daily News quotes the head of the Central Park Conservancy coming out against the antique car idea. But I wonder, would he like to host the stables?
You know, I haven't asked that question, but I will after this. I will definitely get their people on the line. I think that, you know, it's some land in Manhattan is extremely valuable, and no doubt taking away land from one use and putting it to another is going to upset some people. But it just seems to me that we're at least heading in that way as far as the conversation is concerned. There's really a lot of pressure on the mayor right now, and you know, I'm not sure that he has the votes within the city council to pass this. He, you know, he's supported strongly by unions, and those union folks, the drivers, I think to their credit, unionized with the Teamsters because it gave them more power. And, you know, I think that the mayor is going to be under a lot of pressure from, you know, not just the drivers, but their colleagues, their Teamsters. The UFT is on board, the teachers union. So there's a lot of pressure there.
Okay, so let's go to Catherine. She's calling from Brooklyn, New York, and she has something to say about stables. Hi, Catherine.
Yes, hi. How are you? I was just mentioning that there was a huge stable with private horses in it on the Upper West Side a few years ago that was taken over to become luxury housing. So all of those horses and the riders and the people who gave lessons for horses, they were removed totally. And those horses used to come in the park. I said, it seems like a campaign to take the horses and the horse industry out of New York City, because that was one of the last places you could go horseback riding. Now you have to go up to the Bronx or some other borough. I think that they should move some of those taxi cabs out of the park, make a lane, and make areas for those, for the horse carriages to be in the park. And I said also, there is a huge stable there that was designed for horses originally in the park. You can see it when you go off the transverse. And it's being used for police department storage. So I think that they should just try to use the resources that are within the park right now and get some of those areas cleaned up and put the horses and the carriages in the park. I'm sure people would use them just as much. They don't have to be down around 50th Street and in the theatrical area. I see them coming down sometimes when I'm on the West Side Highway to go around to the stable. That's even dangerous during rush hour.
Catherine, thanks so much for calling in. I'm Anusha Marodi, sitting in for Brian Lehrer on The Brian Lehrer Show. And I'm talking to Josh Robin, politics reporter at New York One, about whether or not carriages drawn by horses should be banned here in New York City. And Josh, what do you think about what Catherine said?
I think it's really interesting. I can say that it's going to require a lot of space. There's not just one stable on the west side that currently houses the horses. There are a number of them. They're multi-story, so they're horses living like humans. They're one on top of another. And there's going to be all sorts of questions about whether, you know, you take over private land and convert it to something else. I will say that I'm sure that the property where the horses are currently located is awfully valuable. So maybe if the horse owners have invested like in a co-op in that property, that they would end up doing well and maybe get, you know, free space at a stable run by the city. It just seems like there might have to be fewer. What I'm told is that there would have to be fewer horses within the city for that to happen. But I think that whether that happens is still remains to be seen.
Okay, we do have a caller who does support the ban. Let's go to Madeline in Brooklyn. Hi, Madeline.
Yes, hi. I just really think it's a no-brainer. And I was telling, the gentleman I was just speaking to, I moved back to New York City in 1989 after living out of town for 10 years. And I remember going on a march the day after Thanksgiving. There used to be a march to support animals. And going by the carriage horses, and people were against it then. That was 25 years ago. I don't think this is anything new, and it's not about how they care for their horses. They're changing the conversation to make it about that. It's really about that horses are at risk on the streets of New York City. They've been injured. There have been fatalities. I think that there could be some kind of agreement, maybe just to have them in the park and have a stable in the park. I think a lot of us have made changes in our lives when you become aware of things, and these guys can do the same.
Yeah, it's interesting that, there have been fatalities over the years. There was one report from the health department last year, and I think that the statistics is something like 6 million trips back and forth from horses with 4 fatalities. There have also been, it should be noted, a number of human fatalities, pedestrian fatalities. And, you know, while I was riding on these horses and doing the stories on it, I kind of looked over and, you know, I can't tell, the horse looked okay to me, like didn't particularly look jumpy. But I looked over at a pedicab driver.
Yeah.
And they look really unhappy a lot of the times. I mean, you know, they're also going nose to tailpipe. So
is all of New York City inhumane is what you're saying?
Well, I am saying that it would be – it would be also – I know that the horses don't have a choice in the matter, but it would be also interesting for, you know, people to realize that there are human jobs that go on in the city as well that are, you know, that are difficult for humans.
Do we have any idea about how the treatment of carriage horses compares to, say, racehorses at the aqueduct?
I don't know. I think that they're both highly regulated. I think that there's more reports of impropriety at the racetracks. You hear reports about that all the time. There is a decent amount of regulation that goes on within the city. I think arguably the opponents would say that it's not nearly enough, and that, you know, they can't go out, the horses can't go out when it's extremely hot or extremely cold, but nonetheless they're, you know, standing waiting for fares, whatever the temperature is, for a long time outside of the Plaza Hotel. You know, they say that that's not an ideal by any stretch environment for a horse to be in.
Okay, so we've got another call from a carriage driver, Dave in Manhattan, of course. You're on the line.
Hello.
Hi, Dave. It's Manoush here sitting in for Brian Lehrer.
Okay. I've talked to Brian a couple times. The only thing I could add, Steve, I've known for years, who you were talking to earlier, put it fairly eloquently, is that any accident, first of all, has to be put in the context of the amount of rides. Josh just noted 6 million rides. I go by 68 carriages, two shifts, 136 shifts per day, 9 hours per shift, extrapolates to well over 350,000 equine hours annually. And you put the context of the accidents with that, and you're really negligible. It's an extremely safe industry. Everything that's coming out of the opposition is mendacious. They just don't seem to have, first of all, large mammal equine vets on their side. I've yet to hear one. If this is so abusive, then why don't we hear a compendium of large mammal equine vets weighing in on this? I've heard vets come out on their side, but it didn't come out that they were equine large mammal vets. They were possibly dog and cat vets. That would be like a general practitioner commenting on cardiology. You know, a large mammal equine vet has spent his career studying equine metabolism and muscular skeletal situations. And the other thing is the real estate angle is absolutely true. Nislik, the guy who put up the money for NYCLASS, his firm, Edison Properties, in 2008 came out with, I don't know if you call it a prospectus or an analysis, but it very specifically designated the carriage properties as underutilized, underdeveloped.
Josh, what do you say to that?
Well, I was wondering what you say to those who believe that just the horses standing out in the elements is not in their best interest. You know, the fact that they're lined up on Central Park South.
Well, having been raised in northern Indiana, where the elements are a little more severe in the wintertime, there's horse farms all around where my parents live. And the animal who has a choice to be in the barn or out in the fields, that's what horses do. They're grazing mammals. They stand and essentially look for food. But the carriage drivers take food with them. So I'm not so sure that is a really valid argument. I mean, you could say in the heat we're sent in, we're not allowed to stay out, and in the cold as well. And even if it starts raining hard, the SPCA would come and send us in.
Dave, so, Manoush here, what about the socialization element, the ideas of, you know, horses need other horses?
That's true. And the stables in the stables in the city are such that the horses can contact a box stall has two neighbors, and the horse can contact or is nuzzling the horse in the next stable to that sense. Plus, the horses aren't in – most of the drivers out there have – the horses are 6 months in, 6 months out.
Dave, I'm curious, have you seen video of these – horseless carriages that are around? I'm just really curious to hear whether you all are talking about that, if you've seen it, what you think of it.
Well, I know of the various proposals. This electric car is just idiotic.
But what if one of the owners of another stable, that's what was reported on WNYC, is floating using the actual carriage but just putting a golf cart motor
Chateau
underneath it? Well, what's the deal with Chateau stables?
I don't know. I think they're ponying up for the possibility that we may be outlawed, so they're coming up with probably something else they could use. I mean, people come to the City to take a horse carriage ride. You don't pet a bumper at the end of the ride and try to feed the carrot. I mean, if you can come up with evidence that supports that the horses shouldn't be there, then possibly that would be the way to go. But there literally is nothing that supports that argument.
Dave, thank you so much for calling in. Listeners, if you haven't seen this video, Josh, I don't know if you saw it. It's basically, as you said, by the Chateau Stables. It's a carriage that is run by, I believe, an engine from like a golf cart. Mm-hmm. So it looks kind of like Halloween, like Headless Horseman. It's like a carriage without a horse. It's a little bit spooky, kind of, but also they say completely green and would solve the problem.
Well, it's interesting that this group that has made their money on horses now may be seeing the writing on the wall. And, you know, this – I should note that they have tried this electric – under different circumstances, but they have tried the kind of vintage cars in San Francisco. Again, different circumstances, but the after a number of years, the firm did not make any money and it closed.
Okay. We've got another caller on the line who is supporting the ban. Dave, you are – David, you're on the Upper East Side in Manhattan?
Yes, hello.
Hi there. You're on Brian Lehrer's show. Yeah. Tell us what you think about the carriage rides.
Okay. I'd like to report an incident when I was walking on the Gray Lawn in Central Park late at night. And a carriage was inside the path on the where he was not supposed to be there. And he was riding in the walking path at Gray Lawn. And I'm sure he's not allowed there because I never seen a carriage riding on the Gray Lawn. Over by the Delacorte Theater, and sick of the ball. I was crossing the street. I was crossing the street at the park one time, and the horse carriage was coming on. And he never stopped to allow me to cross the street. Why? Because he had his back turned to the traffic, and he was talking to the people on the carriage.
Okay, David, thank you so much, Josh. I guess it's like little stories like this that sort of. And this is the reason why we're sitting here really talking about this. It's people like David who have, you know, a story that the horses cause trouble.
Right. People have – yeah. I mean, it's not all positive. People don't always have positive experiences from the horses. Some people don't like – apart from the fact that they're, you know, being kept there. They don't like the smell. They feel like they should be not in the city. You do get an awful lot of people coming there, you know, buying a ride as well. This is, you know, it's a really interesting issue. You don't have to be an animal lover to find the issue fascinating. And you know what? It's not going to go on. It's not going to end for a while. This is going to get, in my mind, more and more contentious, especially once you see a bill introduced by the city council. You're going to see crazy protests.
Well, and that's my last question, really, before we wrap it up. Are we now in a negotiation? Does the fact that the mayor didn't act on day one as he promised and now thinks it will take till the end of the year, what does this mean? That we might see further protections or limits on the horses, but not outright elimination?
I really don't know if right now the votes are there. And I think that the mayor's side has really let momentum slip by them on the other side. You know, the Daily News is on this campaign. The unions are getting involved. People are getting riled up. Polls show that most New Yorkers don't want them banned. So I don't know. I don't know if this is going to swing the other way, absent, God forbid, something happening to one of the horses. So, you know, we'll have to see as the nice weather continues. You know, right. I think a lot of attention is going to be on it.
Well, I'm sure you'll be back talking about this. I've been talking to New York One reporter Josh Robin, who also happens to be my husband. I'll see you at dinner time, honey.
Okay. Bye.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Okay, I'm thinking of a city. It's a diverse city with a reputation for tolerance, containing people of 180 nationalities. It's an international business and cultural capital, and it's a low-lying city located by the water and is sometimes prone to flooding. If you just tuned in, you may think I'm talking about New York. If you heard me promote this section, you know it's Amsterdam. And as it happens, the mayor of Old Amsterdam is visiting New Amsterdam today, and we are happy to welcome to our studios Mayor Eberhard van der Laan. Let's compare notes. Mayor van der Laan, welcome. Is it your first time in New York?
No, I've been several times in New York. But
How would you begin to compare New York and Amsterdam on anything? Just as a random question.
The way like you did it. It was a nice introduction. Well, New York is 10 times bigger, and I'm fully aware of that. But there are a lot of similarities, yes, indeed.
I heard a rumor that you're actually here to steal our jobs, to tell everyone what a great city Amsterdam is for doing business. Is that why you're here?
I'm here to tell what a great city Amsterdam is for business, but, you know, trade has as an essence that it's vice versa. So when we cooperate and be partners, like we are already, of course, there will be more jobs for everyone.
Well, you can't have our jobs, but I'm curious how you're making your case, because there's a big disgruntlement right now in New York's business community that our progressive new mayor, Bill de Blasio, is raising workers' issues like paid sick leave and living wages and talking about raising taxes on people making $500,000 a year or more, which is often business owners, all things that Mayor de Blasio has been talking about. Do you want to compete with New York on those issues and say, look, we've got a better business climate?
No, absolutely not. In fact, a bit the contrary. The things you mentioned he wants, I think we mainly already have in the Netherlands as a social state. So that's no competition, no.
So how would you compare minimum wages and paid sick and vacation time guarantees in Amsterdam with New York? What do they get paid in fast food restaurants there? What do they get paid in car washes? Can you convert it to dollars or anything relative?
Well, I think the minimum is in the Netherlands around 1,300 euros. So let's say $1,500.
That's per what?
That's per month.
Oh, $1,500 per month. So less than $400 per week. I would have to do a little more number crunching to figure out just how close it is. But it might actually be a little more. That might be closer to $20,000 a year if it's $400 a week. And that would be significantly higher than a minimum wage worker earns here.
Yeah, well, that would not surprise me because, of course, we have the Rhineland history. In Europe, we compare the Anglo-Saxon working conditions and traditions a bit lower. We estimate them lower than we have in Europe because we think that here it is, more capitalistic.
And so do you have higher unemployment? Because the free marketeers would say if you have, you know, higher wages, then the employers are going to create fewer jobs. Do you have higher unemployment in Amsterdam?
I think we have. In Amsterdam, we have in general a 10% unemployment now. Of course, there is a bit of a crisis still in Europe. But what worries us especially is unemployment amongst youth. That's 20%.
Among youth? That's high.
That's high.
We have that here too.
No, but we think it's very high. And in some neighborhoods, there, of course, also Amsterdam has a bit of a segregation in times of crisis especially. It comes up to 40 or 50%. So that really worries us.
What's the nature of segregation there? New York has been described in a recent study as having the most segregated schools in America. What's the nature of segregation in Amsterdam?
About this you will hear a very chauvinistic mayor because I think it's a tradition in Amsterdam that we're a city of merchants and for centuries they were allowed to strive their own well-being, but always people expected that they would also look behind to those who stayed behind and take them with them. So differences are not so big in our city and we cherish that very much. Have to fight for it every day because it's, of course, the market and nature does not create an equal city by itself. But we can shape it a bit.
How diverse is Amsterdam at this point?
Very much. You mentioned, I think, the 180 nationalities. And we're rather proud of that. It has always been the case in Amsterdam for many centuries that about half of the population is Amsterdam-born and the other has chosen to be there. So there's a little competition between the two, who is the best Amsterdamer.
How much at this point of African descent or Arab descent, South Asian descent?
We have 10% people from Morocco, some 8% origins from Turkey, and I think it's about 15% from Suriname and Antilles. That's Spain.
And both cities have their intergroup tensions. I've heard it said that Amsterdam is so tolerant that it's too intolerant of intolerance. And that usually comes out in the way that says some of your people are tougher on your Muslim residents, assuming they're intolerant toward gay rights, for example. as some would be, depending on the nature of their observance. How much of a problem would you say that is in your city right now, or how much of a tension between tolerance and intolerance of intolerance?
This is going to be complicated, but I think you're right. There is a lot of tolerance. That is partly the history of the city. Being merchants, they had to be tolerant to be successful. Yes, indeed, some of the immigrants has brought along religions and cultural habits that were not exactly in favor of transgenders and homosexuality. So we also have had that tension. But I think on the whole, the people of Amsterdam say, no, you don't touch our tolerance. And the difficult thing, may I add, is that when it comes to liberty, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and all those freedoms, a very important freedom is a freedom from fear, and so safety is connected to it too.
Do you see that as different in the United States, or do you think we're having the same exact conversation?
I think you have the same conversation here, and in times, I think one is ahead, and in other times, the other can be ahead. But New York, like San Francisco, where I came from in the beginning this week, and Amsterdam, they're quite alike.
We are comparing notes with the mayor of Amsterdam, Mayor Eberhard van der Laan. And if you would like to ask him a question, call up 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And to some degree, our cities have reputations for tolerance in different ways. If people have just a casual, stereotypical notion of Amsterdam, they may think, oh, they have legal prostitution, they have legal euthanasia, they have legal hashish coffee shops. We don't have those things. So is there something about those, that nexus, that defines tolerance Amsterdam style or Netherlands style?
This tolerance is, as I said, originates from early days of Amsterdam, when the merchants had to be tolerant because immigrants in those days created added value to the city.
And very similar to New York in that respect, yeah. And I think coastal cities all over the world.
Yeah, but I think I might be a little chauvinistic about the fact that it was rather early in Amsterdam in the 17th century, and it was substantial. Did you know that Amsterdam was then 70% of world trade was Amsterdam-based? So what New York was in the 20th century, London in the 19th, Paris in the 18th, really, Amsterdam was in the 17th century. And the tolerance has become an institution. For we have churches. There was a governing religion that was Protestantism. But the Catholics, they were always allowed to have churches in the backyards. So that's, of course, it's a bit opportunistic, I must admit. But it has always been a basis of the city.
I don't know if you could see our phone board light up over there, but it looks like half of New York wants to talk to you.
I like that.
So Glenn in Richmond Hill, you're on WNYC with the mayor of Amsterdam.
Thanks for letting me ask the mayor a question about Amsterdam's bicycle transportation system. How does Amsterdam promote and foster a bicycle culture when New York City's recently instituted bicycle system is already in financial difficulty?
Well, thank you for the question. I must say we have a bit of luck because we are a flat country. So cycling, we already do that for a century. And indeed, it is very nice in terms of sustainability. Amsterdam is also small. So that could seem a disadvantage, but in fact it is an advantage of being small. And 50% of the Amsterdamers do cycle every day. And it's interesting to say that our problem is not to get the Amsterdamers on the bike, but we have a huge problem in parking bikes and make them. And another problem is they consider themselves a bit the rulers of town, so they should have a better behavior towards those who walk on the streets.
I have to say that the one time that I was in Amsterdam, it was in January. It was freezing cold. There was snow and ice on the ground. And I was amazed that people were biking. I don't know if they had snow tires or chains or what.
No.
And they were tying them up everywhere on every railing. I took some photos because I was so struck by the by the sort of ubiquitous bicycle landscape of Amsterdam, and that people kept going and people tied them up outside in the snow. So it's certainly a hardy city when it comes to bicycle culture. The caller was specifically interested, I think, in a bike share program, which is having some financial difficulties in New York. Do you have something like that in Amsterdam?
No, but we don't need to, because the average Dutchman has 1.7 bikes. So why should we share 1.7 bikes per individual?
What do they do? Do they keep a road bike and a mountain bike?
Or? Usually for in town, also because of fear for theft. There quite a few bikes are stolen. They have an old, ugly bike for daily use. But when they want to do a tour or something, they take the other bike.
The security experts say in New York the best advice is keep a crappy bike but a great lock. Jennifer in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jennifer.
Yeah, hi. I just want to say I just got back from Amsterdam. Fantastic city. But I was actually going to make a similar point, is that a lot of the comparisons are so difficult to make because your city's so small, and you just said that actually, and ours is at least, I think, 10 times bigger. I don't know how much bigger in landmass, but definitely population. So I think we have to, how do you think we can kind of, what things can we best transfer from the fabulousness of Amsterdam to New York City and its crazy largeness?
Having just visited it, Jennifer, with fresh eyes, what would you want to? Anything on first impression?
Well, it's more the people and how relaxed they are and calm. I think that's a lot of the bike culture there. You know, it's just much, much freer.
Uh-huh. And people are
feeling
more relaxed. You think it's a chill city, Amsterdam?
Yeah, not always. But I think Jennifer is right. New York is 10 times as bigger, more or less. And it creates more traffic, more tension. So that is not an asset of Amsterdam, or a merit of Amsterdam, I should say. But it is Amsterdam is not only a place where you can be born or where you come to live. It has become also a kind of mentality, and people they really get Amsterdamers, and they can live in New York as well.
Ryan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with the mayor of Amsterdam. Hi.
Yes. Hi. How's it going?
Okay.
My question was that although, yes, New York is the great melting pot, we still do have a lot of segregation in the city, and there are many different cultures, but they often tend to stay to themselves. I was wondering if there was anything that you guys do in Amsterdam to combat segregation.
That's a good question, but the answer would be too long if I tell you all the things we try to do, because we're not always successful. But it has been for more than a century that there is a housing policy, especially, in which we try to get represented neighborhoods where everyone can live. And we had one terrible lucky thing. Already in the 19th century, workers' communities started housing corporations. And a large part of the houses in Amsterdam are owned by these housing corporations, and they give us an instrument to make sure that we don't get very rich neighborhoods and very poor neighborhoods. So that's a bit of luck, too, that we owe to our ancestors.
Oh, Nanette in Ridgewood, New Jersey is going to be a troublemaker because she's still thinking about our last segment on legal rights for animals. Nanette, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Okay.
When I was there in the late 60s, I went into a very small Amsterdam restaurant, and there was a dog in the restaurant, and they told me at 8:30 at night, there's no food for you, but, you know, the dog is licking its chops. So, I mean, is that still permitted, and how do they prevent, you know, proximity of other dogs, and does that still go on?
We were just I know you weren't here yet. We were just having a conversation before you came up about how much pets, dogs in particular, should be allowed into restaurants and stores and other public places.
I heard one sentence, and I laughed at the term bureaucrats. Well, the lady comes from dangerous territory because I used to have a dog, so I'm in favor of dogs, and I think we have no regulations in Amsterdam that dogs couldn't be in restaurants. But of course, there are all kinds of rules on sanitary and healthy, and health. So The behavior should be appropriate.
And it depends on the restaurant.
It depends also on the restaurant.
They can bar dogs.
But there's no
general rule. Doesn't happen very much.
No, you hardly see it.
All right. Well, there you go. There's more fodder for the legal rights for animals movement.
Yes.
I got an email yesterday from our mutual friend, Ben Barber, author of the book, If Mayors Ruled the World, Als Bürgermeister Zuden Regeren. Is that close?
Yes, it's close.
You say it. If mayors ruled the world in Dutch?
Als Bürgermeister zou regeren.
Thank you. Well, I was not close at all.
Well, a bit.
And his book just came out in Dutch, so he sent me that transliteration, but it didn't come to much. But he mentioned the Netherlands as a nation of cities in a Europe of cities, a fundamentally different relationship, a more supportive relationship between national governments and cities than in the United States. Would you say that's the case as Ben Barber sees it?
I think he sees it perfectly right, and I find his book very inspiring. I had the honor of talking to him a few times. But there is always a difference that should be mentioned. In the Netherlands, mayors are not elected directly by the citizens. They are chosen by the city council and then officially appointed by the government. While here, of course, you have the directly elected mayors. So I think in the United States, mayors have a lot more responsibilities and authority. And then his theory is more substantial than in the Dutch situation. But still, his analysis, I share.
Don in Lambertville, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Maybe you have an expert now. Maybe you and your people and the good mayor can clear up this story that I once heard. I would like to thank the Dutch for all their influences in this country. What most noticeable today is the architecture that we see, you know, especially in the downtown and the older areas of New York City. But getting back to the tolerance issue, I heard a story, and maybe the mayor can, or you guys can confirm it for me, that when Peter Stuyvesant first came and they founded New Amsterdam, that there was a boat came in and it had Jewish people on it. And Peter Stuyvesant did not want to let Jews come onto the island, but that the folks, his bosses back in Amsterdam, said to him, no way, we don't care what they are. We want everybody to come in. And that's how the early Jewish people came onto Manhattan over Peter Stuyvesant's objection.
Don, I'm going to leave it there, but your question is clear. And, of course, that's New York history, not Amsterdam history. But do you learn that when you take history in the Netherlands? Do you know if that's true?
Brian, that's New Amsterdam history, and thus, in a way, this man is right. It is also New York history. I don't know his specific story, but I know Peter Stuyvesant was by origin an Englishman who was hired by the Dutch VOC, the Dutch tradesmen that sent the ships all over the world. So he was working on the authority of the Dutch. And maybe, I don't know the story, but I can imagine, because Amsterdam was in those days already really a place for refugees, Jewish people from Portugal, but also Eastern Europe.
New Amsterdam was.
But no,
originally
Amsterdam,
uh-huh.
and that was then already the case for some 50 years. So I really can imagine that this man is right. But the interesting thing is about New Amsterdam and New York. I was in a conference where Mr. Bloomberg held a wonderful speech, but a bit too bold about New York. And then I made a joke in my table where the Manchester mayor was. And I said, come on, Mr. Bloomberg, we founded you. And then the mayor of Manchester said, oh, no, you didn't. You founded New Amsterdam. We founded New York. So I am a bit careful on the issue, but you could argue.
I guess so. I wish I was a fly on the wall for that conversation between you and the mayor of Manchester and Michael Bloomberg. But I think the thrust of – and I don't know the particular, but I think the thrust of Don's story is true, that it was a more tolerant place when the Dutch ruled New York than when the British – did right afterwards, and then some of that had to be recaptured. We're almost out of time, but two things that need to come up when we're comparing notes between Amsterdam and New York. Rebuilding post-Sandy. Amsterdam always as a model with dikes out in the water and, you know, parts of the Netherlands and things like that. Amsterdam actually lies below sea level, right?
1.5 meters.
And someone told me your approach to managing water is not always to keep it out, but in some ways to let it in.
Yes, I think water management, as we call it, is very important, and it's really an expertise. It's, a lot of Dutch are working in it. We have a problem, though. The average inhabitant of our country is not even aware that we have all those systems and that he would be a fish if we hadn't had those systems.
Canals, really, right?
The canals is one of the early products of the water management, and we're so glad that they build them because they're also quite nice to look at.
Advice for New York? Should we have an actual canal on Canal Street or something along those lines?
No, I'm not in a position to give any advice, but I know New York is doing also a lot on water management, and we make our mistakes also in Amsterdam. Our architects built data centers below sea level. And, of course, when we have a flood, that is not a very good situation. But, yes, may I add this, Brian? I told you we were a city of merchants that were independent, not a city of kings and bishops. But the second thing is, because of this water situation, they had to cooperate. So it's a fine combination of ownership. They thought the city was theirs, but there was also the need to cooperate to keep it alive.
And everyone is always curious, before you go, when talking about Amsterdam, about the legal cannabis cafes.
I knew you would ask the question.
Am I right that there is a backlash against those because they actually do lead to more crime in those areas?
No, but we in Amsterdam, we have some 200 coffee shops, and that's we have 4 big cities. That's 2 times as much as the other 3 cities, Rotterdam, The Hague, and Utrecht. And what we try to do is to get more distance between schools and coffee shops. So those coffee shops too close in the neighborhood of schools, they will be closed, and we will maintain some 160, which still is, I hope you trust me, quite enough.
But maybe Washington State and Colorado here have jumped over you. Are you watching those experiments to not just limit it to coffee shops, but to just make it, well, anybody can have it anyway, so maybe you don't need those districts with their problems?
Absolutely, and I admire Colorado for this because we still have a problem, what we call at the back door. It is legal to sell it to individuals, and they can legally buy it, but it is illegal to give storage to the shops. And that is a typical Dutch gedoog tolerance situation, and Colorado is really state of the art in solving that problem.
Anything else you want to say to the people of New Amsterdam from the mayor of Old Amsterdam?
That I enjoy very much being in New York because, believe me, when I say all Amsterdamers that have been to New York, they love it.
Meeting with Mayor de Blasio while you're here?
No, I understood that he was in his 100th day and having a lot of effort to explain what he had done.
Just say pre-K a lot and maybe he'll let you come in. Pre-K.
Pre-K.
Yeah, I'll explain after the show.
Okay.
Eberhard van der Laan, the mayor of Amsterdam. A delight to meet you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.